archaeological excavations in Greece. It's a great pleasure to see so many of you here tonight. I suspect many of you were here 4 years ago this month, February in fact, in 2000 when our speaker tonight, Professor Brian Rose, spoke about his excavations at the ancient city of Troy. We had a full house that night, and we have pretty much a full house tonight, which is testimony to the speaker and his subject. Brian Rose was educated at Haverford College and Bryn Mawr College and did his graduate work at Columbia University. He is a distinguished scholar of the Greco-Roman period in the Near and Middle East and has been working in Turkey excavating Greco-Roman sites since the early 1980s. After five seasons digging at Aphrodisias, the great city in Caria, an excavation sponsored by the National Geographic Foundation, he turned his attention when he became a faculty member at the University of Cincinnati, which, as many of you know, has long connections with UBC. He turned his attention to the city of Troy, where Cincinnati had dug in the 30s and began to dig again in a joint German-American project that has been going on for 15 or 16 years now. His talk to us tonight, however, moves further afield and into the furthest reaches of Hellenism. It's a very appropriate subject for his visit here because while on the previous occasion he was sponsored by the Archaeological Institute of America's Vancouver Society, on this occasion he is sponsored by the Alexander Onassis Foundation. As many of you know, Aristotle Onassis was one of the world's richest men, great fleet of oil tankers. His only son, Alexander, was killed in a plane crash in the 1970s, and he set a foundation up to honor his memory. One of the things the foundation does, besides all sorts of good works in areas like the medical research, is to sponsor visiting lecturers around Canada and the United States. This is the first occasion that UBC has had an Onassis speaker. Professor Rose has been with us since Tuesday, and this is his fourth talk to large audiences, although I think this one is as big as all the others combined, but there have been very well-received talks, and it's a pleasure on many accounts. Our friendship goes back to 1982 when we and Caroline, my wife, and I met him in an airport in Turkey and then visited Aphrodisias after that. His talk tonight follows in the footsteps of the great Macedonian conqueror, about whom we're going to hear a lot this spring because there is a film underway, I think with Brad Pitt as Alexander the Great. And a film on Troy as well, or is that, anyway, Brian was telling us there are five documentaries in the works for different television channels on Troy, and I think he appears in all of them. Anyway, without further digression, I would like to introduce Professor Brian Rose. I would also like to thank, in addition to the Onassis Foundation for bringing him here, the Pharos, the Canadian Hellenic Cultural Society, Omega Travel, and Talia Charis Taliodouros from Van den Bosch Bakery for providing the refreshments tonight, because this is actually another very important thing I almost forgot to say. Normally we have a little reception for 20 or 30 people afterward, but tonight the Greek community sees this as such an important event. You're all invited to coffee and tea and cookies out in the lobby at the end of the talk. Brian Rose.
Thank you, Hector. Thanks again to the Alexander Onassis Foundation for having brought me to Vancouver and to all of you for having come out on a Saturday night. As I said to Hector, this wouldn't happen in the States because we would never be able to get this many people to an archaeological lecture on a Saturday evening. One correction I want to make in Hector's very generous introduction, Brad Pitt is Achilles in the Trojan War film. And there is not one but two Alexander the Great epics that are going to open in the course of the summer and fall, one starring Colin Farrell as Alexander the Great, the other Leonardo DiCaprio as Alexander the Great. So you can just file that away with Angelina Jolie as Olympias, his mother. Tonight, I want to deal with a very broad area from modern-day Greece all the way east to India and about a 1,000-year period from the 6th century BC through the 3rd century AD, focusing on the Empire of Persia, its interaction with the Greeks, the campaigns of Alexander, and the ways in which both Iraq and Afghanistan changed in the course of the campaigns of Alexander the Great, the government of the Persian Empire, and the entry of the Indian kings, the Chinese groups, and the Sasanian kings into that area in the Roman period. So we'll be covering a very broad temporal and spatial scope. You will have gathered from the slides on the screen at the moment that I very much want you to understand the similarities, the connections that exist between what happened in antiquity in these regions and what's going on now. You're seeing on the left the colossal statue of Saddam Hussein in downtown Baghdad being pulled down by an American tank over here. And on the right, a member of the Taliban having just decapitated a first century AD marble statue from the Kabul Archaeological Museum. These are unfortunately very interesting times in which we live, in the sense that there are so many systematic attempts to erase history, history being erased both through iconoclasm and through the systematic looting of archaeological sites in these countries that are so war-torn and have been over the course of several decades. In the course of these wars and battles that take place in Iraq and Afghanistan in particular, there aren't enough security agents to guard the archaeological sites, and so they're being systematically plundered with objects from Iraq, Iran, Afghanistan, and for that matter, Greece and Turkey as well, being steadily sold to markets abroad. You can find Babylonian cylinder seals on eBay all of a sudden, as well as the same sort of thing from southern Afghanistan showing up in the same area. This attitude toward the erasure of history, which you see attested here in iconoclasm, is abundantly attested as well in antiquity, and that's something that I want to stress in the course of the talk. I want to begin with the Persian Empire, which will be our entree into Greece, which of course will be one of the main focal points of the lecture tonight. The Persian Empire was enormous. It's hard for us to gauge how large it actually was, but it reached from southeastern Europe and Turkey, up here in the upper left corner of the screen on this map, all the way to India over here, and from the Caspian Sea down to the Nile and into Ethiopia. It's an empire that gets started in the 6th century BC and would continue until the campaigns of Alexander in the later 4th century BC. The founder of the empire was a man named Cyrus the Great, whose tomb at Pasargadae in western Iran you see on the screen on the right. Here the tomb of Cyrus, and here the Shah of Iran standing in front of the tomb of Cyrus. The Shah, of course, regarded Cyrus as one of his ancestors, although 2,500 years earlier than the reign that he had in the late 60s and early 70s. Cyrus was the one who carved out much of what we now think of as the Persian Empire, conquering Egypt, conquering the Lydians in western Turkey, conquering the Babylonians, and extending the empire as far as Afghanistan, which you see here in the center of the map. The empire was expanded even further by his successor, one of his successors, a man named Darius, ruling the Persian Empire in the late 6th, early 5th centuries BC. It was Darius who established who built most of the buildings in the Persian capital at Persepolis, in southwestern Iran, near the modern city of Shiraz, which you see on the left side. You also see some elaborate tents in the background. This was taken on the occasion of the Shah's 2,500th year anniversary of the foundation of the Persian Empire in 1971, where Persepolis became a kind of carnival atmosphere, celebrating the connections between the ruling regime in Iran and the founder of the Persian dynasty 2,500 years earlier. Most of these columns from the palace were set in place by Darius in the late 6th century BC and filled with reliefs that showed all the nations that were subject to the Persians, of which there were 45. And one of these reliefs you see on the right, this is one of the successors of Darius, a king named Xerxes, about whom we'll hear more later, fighting a lion with his bare hands, which is a very common motif in these reliefs from the Persian kingdom. We can get a better sense of Darius from a rock-cut relief at the site of Behistun in southwestern Iran, which is about 150 kilometers west of Persepolis, so west of the modern city of Shiraz. This is often called the Persian Rosetta Stone because it's an enormous rock-cut relief with both images and inscriptions, the inscriptions in three languages, Neo-Elamite, Akkadian, and Old Persian. And the inscriptions are very easy to read and stand literally above this image of Darius with his foot on a captured enemy and other enemies or other foes who had battled the reign, the rule of the conquests of Darius, yoked in front of him. This was on one of the most important trade routes between Babylon and India. And so as you were walking along this trade route on a caravan, if you looked up 300 feet, you would see this 20-foot high relief and read these inscriptions. I am Darius, the great king, the king of kings, the king in Persia, the king of all countries. Another man called himself king of Media, which is the region of northwestern Iran. I sent my army after him and he was seized. I cut off his nose and ears and tongue, and I put out his eyes. He was held bound at my court. All the people saw him. Afterward, I put him on a cross at Ecbatana, which is another major Persian city. And so he's eliminated the parts of the body that are connected to the senses and then has crucified him. Another man, a Sargatian, became rebellious to me by the grace of Ahura Mazda, who was the primary god of Persia and the winged figure who hovers over this group on the right. My army smote his rebellious army utterly. Afterwards, I cut off his nose and ears and I put out his eyes. He was held bound at my court. All the people saw him. Afterward, I put him on a cross in Arbela. This is Erbil in northern Iraq, ancient Gaugamela, which is now part of Kurdistan and has been the site of quite a number of battles in the recent Iraqi wars. Says Darius the king, if you see this inscription or these sculptures, as you are now doing 2,500 years later, and if you destroy them, may Ahura Mazda be a smiter unto you, and may there not be unto you a family, and whatever you do, let that be destroyed by Ahura Mazda. It continues on and on with the same sort of focus. You notice some of the main themes. Iconoclasm, the battering of the head, the destruction of those features that individualize the enemy, and a warning not to deface the monument. Even this early in the late 6th century, there was a fear of iconoclasm, that history could be erased by subsequent rulers. And so there were strict mandates against doing this and clear indications of the kind of punishment, divine punishment, that would befall you if you tried it. Now, this empire was so enormous that there were regional capitals, each of which was the residence of a man called a satrap, S-A-T-R-A-P, a local Persian governor. And so you find these satrapal capitals, these regional capitals of the Persian Empire, as far west as northwestern Turkey, at the site of Daskilion, which you're also seeing on the right, and that's a site I'm going to talk about in more detail in a minute, at Sardis in western Turkey and Halicarnassus, the site of the famous mausoleum. And throughout the Persian Empire, all the way into Afghanistan, you'll find these regional satrapal capitals. Fortunately, I've been able to get a better sense of what one of these Persian satrapal capitals looked like from the late 6th century BC by virtue of our excavations at Troy of a series of tombs near the Persian capital of Daskilion, these tombs lying about an hour's drive east of Troy. These are relatively recent. I showed you a few slides of them when I was here 4 years ago, but I just want to reintroduce them to you. These satrapal capitals had paradise-like areas. They were called literally paradises, where they would be stocked with animals and birds that one could use in hunting. And so there were, in a sense, animal sanctuaries, except the animals weren't safe. They were hunted by the satrapal governor and his associates. But all around here, you have aristocrats who were growing rich on the money of the satrap, who in turn was living off of the money of the Persian king. In exploring some of the cemeteries in this region, associated with the satrapal capital, where there had been attempts at looting during the last decade, we were lucky enough to find this sarcophagus, which is representative of the way in which the aristocrat wanted himself or herself to be remembered. You see here a sarcophagus from the late 6th century, contemporary with the reign of Darius. In the course of excavation, you can see it had been robbed in antiquity because the robbers had cut a hole in the roof of the sarcophagus. But as we cleared away these terracotta tiles that you see on the left, which surrounded a series of reliefs, we found that the sarcophagus was decorated with reliefs on all four sides. So the earliest stone sarcophagus with figural scenes ever to have been found in the Mediterranean. Two of the reliefs, those that you see here, focus on scenes from the Persian War, or from the Trojan War, which is understandable given the fact that Troy is just down the road. You have the murder of the daughter of King Priam, a woman named Polyxena, by the son of Achilles, a man named Neoptolemus, who stands by the tomb of his father Achilles. And then Polyxena's mother, Hecuba, crouches mourning beneath this bare tree on the right, as Trojan women mourn the murder on both sides. Then on the reverse, you have a kind of symposium scene representing the kind of paradise in which the deceased was believed to have lived, a paradise where there would be no toil, no trouble. It would just be a kind of perpetual banquet. And so that's what you see. The person for whom the tomb was originally intended, I think, i.e. this woman, who was seated on a throne, and you see a detail of her on the right, sniffing a flower, which is a very common motif for this period, and being brought funerary gifts, plates of eggs, mirrors, perfume vessels, we call these alabastra, fillets or ribbons that had been recently dyed, probably with Tyrian purple, some of which we found in the tombs, and then a series of female musicians playing the flute, the aulos, the kithara, and various other musical instruments, as four Pyrrhic dancers, or male dancers in armor, are in the process of putting on a kind of spectacle for these female musicians. And you can see they're dancing because they're standing on tiptoe, which again is iconographical shorthand for dancing. You see a detail here of the plate of eggs that's being brought to the deceased woman, and she's holding one of the eggs in her hand. This sort of biographical narrative is something that you don't really find in contemporary art in Greece. It's something that seems to thrive, especially in Western Asia Minor, in cities that are under the control of the Persian Empire. There would be a series of wars between the Greeks and the Persians that would develop right at the beginning of the 5th century BC. We call them, of course, the Persian Wars, and they would go on for about 20 years. You're seeing on the left a map of part of Persia, Turkey, and Greece here, and on the right, some of the ruins of the Persian capital at Persepolis in southwestern Iran. At the beginning of the 5th century BC, some of the residents of the Greek town of Miletus on the west coast of Turkey joined forces with some of the Athenians, and they marched inland toward the east and burned the satrapal capital of the Persians at Sardis. The Persians ultimately charged back and punished severely the people of Miletus in 495, 494, and the other cities that had joined up in rebellion against the Persian Empire, which at this point controlled virtually all of Western Asia Minor. Having punished the people of Miletus was not enough. The Persians were determined to punish the Athenians as well for the role that they had played in this uprising against Persian administration in Western Turkey. And so in the early 5th century BC, Darius begins an expedition that will take the Persians from Persia itself through Turkey over the north of Greece and down toward Athens. There would be a number of battles that would occur here, but as the army marches toward Greece, they stop in Troy, of all places, and make offerings to the Trojan heroes. At this point, Troy is viewed as a city of Asia, and the people who lived in ancient Troy as kinsmen of the Persians. And so the Persian kings stop here, make offerings to the Trojan heroes in particular, since they are kinsmen of theirs as being people of Asia, sacrifice 1,000 oxen to those Trojan heroes, which is an easy way of getting a lot of free meat for your army, which they need, because they're about to go off and attempt to sack Greece. And here you see an aerial view of the Mound of Troy on the left, and one of the mounds in the distance near Troy that was believed to have been one of the tombs of the Greek and Trojan heroes. These mounds dotting the landscape and all associated with the legendary figures from Homer's War. Darius marches toward Greece, down through the country, and there is a major battle at Marathon where the Persians are defeated. The Athenians and the Plataeans are successful in defeating the Persians in 490 BC. At this battle, there were 192, according to the Greek historians, 192 Athenians who were killed and 6,400 Persians. And they felt that there was a need to commemorate this victory, which was considered a great victory because, of course, the Persian Empire, as I've told you, stretched from northwestern Turkey all the way to India. So they build a mound to commemorate this battle. Of course, designing war memorials is something that so many regions, so many cities, so many groups are now concerned with, especially in New York City. But also, it's been a concern in Iran, and I'm sure it will now be a concern in Iraq and Afghanistan. In Marathon in 490 BC, what they did was to bury the deceased in this large mound, not in shape unlike the mound that I just showed you, not far from Troy, and they inscribed the names of those who had died on stone slabs that were set around the base of the memorial. So in essence, this is what was done with the Vietnam War Memorial, although more than 2,000 years later. It gets its start here, singling out the names of the dead, using text as a fundamental part of the battle monument to honor those who died in the battle. One of the things I want to do as I go through these slides is also to single out the kinds of war memorials that in antiquity were deemed appropriate for commemorating the loss that had occurred during these battles. Because again, that's something that so many people are facing today, finding the right design whereby architecture and memory combine to indicate the kind of loss, the extent of the loss that the battles have engendered. The Persians would strike back and actually made it to Athens in 480 BC and sacked the city. Now, the Athenians had left before the sack occurred, but as the Persians went into the city, they sacked the most important sanctuary there, which is commonly what's done in the course of attacks, both in antiquity, in the Middle Ages, even in the modern period. People will go after the primary religious site in the town, and Athens was no exception. They go to the Acropolis and destroy the temples that had been built there. Now, the Parthenon, the temple dedicated to Athena, was not yet built, although there was an earlier version of that that was destroyed as the Persians swept through the area. The Persians would be defeated a year later at the battles of Salamis and Plataea in 479, and the Greeks for about 30 years decided to leave the Acropolis and its ruined buildings as a war memorial, so leaving the ruin as an indication of the savagery of their opponents, of the Persians who had come in and sacked their most sacred structures. So the ruin became a memorial in and of itself. And this, of course, is something that one can still find, especially in the 20th century. I'm showing you on the right a slide of the memory church, the Gedächtniskirche in downtown Berlin, which, of course, is a ruin as a consequence of the Allied bombings at the end of World War II. But you could also cite Coventry Cathedral or any number of buildings in Hiroshima and Nagasaki that have been left as ruins along the same lines as what was done for the Parthenon in Athens between 479 and 447, when construction begins again on a set of new buildings. Those new buildings included a new Parthenon, this temple to Athena. Athena was Parthenos, she was a maiden. And so the Parthenon is simply the temple to the maiden goddess. That temple, finally finished in 432, featured a series of metopes, or square architectural reliefs, that didn't show the battle between the Greeks and Persians, but conveyed the idea through a series of mythological battles, one of which you see on the screen, centaurs, half man, half horse, battling Lapiths, Greeks who ultimately emerged victorious. There would be battles between the Athenians and the Amazons, which would be singled out, the Greeks and the centaurs, the Trojan War, the Greeks and the Trojans, as well as the gods and the giants. So they're not commemorating the war by replicas of the actual battles that occurred here during the Persian Wars, but doing it all through analogy with these mythological scenes. As we move into the early 4th century BC and closer toward Alexander, even though the Persian Wars had been over for a while, they really were never over. The wars between the Greeks and the Persians would continue through the early 4th century, and so we find the region of western Turkey alternately governed by or overseen by the Athenians, the Spartans, the Persians, the Mytileneans, or a combination thereof. And in the early 4th century in particular, we find the Spartans once again coming into this area, and we're looking here at a map of northwestern Turkey, and sacking the Persian satrapal capital at Daskylion and burning all of the villages in the area. So this is early 4th century BC. We were lucky enough to find a tomb, or rather the looters found it for us, that illustrates one of the battles that would have taken place during this period between Greeks and the local Anatolian aristocrats who were in the service of the Persian king. The tomb in question was found at the site of Chon, which is near the area of Granicus, which would be one of Alexander's main battles against the Persians. And as you see in the slide on the right, this is a sarcophagus where nearly all the paint still survives on the reliefs, although the looters had moved into the tomb with a bulldozer. So they had clawed away at the tomb with a bulldozer with the front end loader attached, knowing that eventually they would hear the sound of metal striking marble, and that even if the tomb chamber were destroyed, it wouldn't be that important because they wouldn't be able to sell the tomb chamber, but they could theoretically sell the gold jewelry that they hoped to find inside. They didn't find anything inside. It had been robbed in antiquity. Here's the ancient, it was true for many of these tombs. Here's the ancient robber's mark on the upper section from the robbery, and the bulldozer clawed away the left half of the sarcophagus, as you see here, but the two scenes relating to yet another biographical narrative survive, and the paint is preserved on both of them, and we've recently conserved it. Now, this is an area and a set of monuments that we call Greco-Persian, because the style in general is Greek. You have sculptors who were being trained by some Greeks, in all probability, in carving techniques, but the subjects, The iconography is drawn to a great extent from what you would have found in contemporary Persia. And these are two examples that are cases in point. You see the deceased man here, deceased man in the sarcophagus, in the hunt and then in the battle. This is the same man, showing him victorious in two different arenas during his life. You see that he's dressed in good Persian garb. He wears pants, as no Greek at this point would have done, has a good Persian scabbard and a sleeved cloak with ermine trim, which is standard Persian garb, and a good Persian saddle blanket. The tail of the horse has been tied in a knot, decorated with ribbons. And he's spearing originally in the eye this very large boar, which is being attacked by his hunting dogs. You see the same kind of thing on the right, but in the field of battle. And this probably relates to one of these battles between the Greeks and their Persian associates, or the Anatolian associates of the Persian king, that occurred in the early 4th century BC. So you're seeing again the deceased man on horseback, again another good Persian saddle, this very unusual Persian armor, which cannot have been comfortable to wear, and he's spearing in the eye a fallen Greek. So a Greek wearing a fillet has fallen under this wooded scene with a bird watching from the branches of the tree, and he's being speared in the eye as the boar was originally being speared in the eye. So they use the spear eye motif to indicate the two foes, one animal and one human. Now, the Greeks won during these battles. They burned all the cities, but that didn't matter. It was this man who was paying for the tomb. So he gets to show himself winning, although keep in mind that this is a fictive part of the biographical narrative. One interesting thing about the other side, the side that had been clawed off by the bulldozer, is that there was a stag hunt represented there, and you see how well preserved the paint is. Originally, there were two figures hunting stags, one here, which you see blown up on the right side, and then one here, which was finished and then chiseled away. You can see the head of the horse here. Here are the nostrils of the horse, the rider, the cloak of the rider, the back of the horse with the knotted tail and the ribbons decorating the tail. And there was paint still surviving on the tail, which means that they had finished the representation of the second horseman, and then they had chiseled him off. So these tombs were done before the man died. You couldn't go to sarcophagus workshops and just, or showrooms, and just pull one off the showroom floor. They were all done in advance. And so it looks as if they finished the sarcophagus representing several associates of the man who was sick, having fallen from his horse, probably in a battle. This man here, the one who was chiseled off, had obviously done something terribly, terribly wrong. And they simply chiseled him off the surface of the sarcophagus. Before this, before the early 4th century BC, it wasn't necessary to do this because everybody had generic portraits. But around 400 BC, we get into the beginning of portraiture, the beginning of individualized features that mark a particular individual on the tomb as a specific person. You see that individuality showing up in the second horseman with this bulbous nose, this very short Beatles-like haircut, these thick lips, this little goatee. You won't find another portrait like that anywhere in ancient art. In fact, if I had found it on the art market, I would have thought it was a forgery because it looks so unusual. One can assume that the same sort of individuality was used for the second horseman, and that he was simply chiseled away, again, after he had done something terribly wrong. Now, this kind of damnatio, this iconoclasm, is not something that you would have found in contemporary Greece, but you do find it in contemporary Persia. So if you were to look at some of the reliefs in Persepolis, or think of the inscriptions on the Behistun monument of Darius that describes the obliteration of the face, it's the same sort of attitude toward iconoclasm that's showing up here. So you have an interesting mixture, as I say, of Greek and Persian, hence the title Greco-Persian. Once we get into the second half of the 4th century, we move into the regime of Alexander the Great and the dominance of Macedonia. As most of you know, Alexander the Great was the son of a man named Philip, whose tomb may or may not have been found in Macedonia. And he, in being a member of Philip's dynasty, which was the Argead dynasty, could trace his descent from Heracles, the great Greek hero who had been a human, had died, and then had become a god, and also the father of Heracles, which is Zeus. So he had a divine descent, which he highlighted every chance he got. And I'm showing you a coin of Alexander on the right, with the head of Heracles on one side, wearing the lion skin on his head, and then Heracles' father Zeus on the opposite side, which is probably a fairly close reproduction of the cult statue of Zeus in his temple at Olympia. Alexander, in 334, would embark upon a campaign to conquer the Persians once and for all. So at the age of 22, because he had been born in 356, he would begin his march from Macedonia. This is a sort of dizzying slide, but it was the only one I could find that would show everything I wanted to show, from Macedonia in northeastern Greece into Turkey, across Turkey, actually down to Egypt, and then up again through modern-day Iraq, through Iran into Afghanistan, Uzbekistan, Pakistan, and India, and then back again to Iraq. So the kind of journey and the kind of campaign that no one had before attempted that would bring Hellenic culture all the way to northwestern India. Alexander stopped at Troy on his way east, as had the Persian kings when they were on their way west, each one claiming Troy for his own purposes. The Persian kings had viewed Troy as an Asian city. Their kinsmen had lived there. Alexander is going to claim it for the people of the West and for the Greeks. He will go to the Temple of Athena, will exchange his armor for armor that was kept in the temple that had allegedly been used during the Trojan War. And so that tells us that there was a Trojan War treasury kept in the temple by that point. Who knows what there was that was there, but anytime you dig at Troy, you find something from the Bronze Age, from the second millennium BC. And so all you need is good spin control to make that piece of bronze, originally having belonged to Achilles. It could be worthless, you know, it could be nothing of any value whatsoever. But again, the label is everything. And so Alexander left his armor there, which then automatically became an additional part of the treasury in the temple, and took this Trojan War armor with him. He ran around the tomb of Achilles, which you're seeing on the right. This is, again, an aerial view of the Mound of Troy on the left, and you can imagine Alexander standing right here as he made offerings to Athena and dealt with the Trojan War treasury. Then he went to this mound, originally a pointed mound called Sivri Tepe, which was always associated with the tomb of Achilles in antiquity as well as today. And he ran around the tomb of Achilles, duplicating the actions of some of the Greek heroes that had fought in the Trojan War. Then he went off in pursuit of the Persian king, a man named Darius, in this case Darius III. There would be three major battles in which he would be engaged with the Persian forces. One at Granicus, which is the same area where that painted sarcophagus was found that I just showed you. One at Issus, which is in southeastern Turkey, where there's currently a NATO base, so near the modern town of Adana. And then one at Gaugamela in northern Iraq, modern-day Erbil, in Kurdistan, where there's been so much fighting in the course of the last year. These cities that witnessed battles in antiquity continue to witness them, often for the same reasons. We get a representation of one or more of these battles surviving from Pompeii, from the House of the Faun, probably about 100 BC, but replicating a painting that was done to commemorate Alexander's battles with the Persians in the late 4th century BC. In this case, you see Alexander here, and also enlarged on the right, on his horse Bucephalus, which simply means ox head. He had a branding mark in the shape of an ox head, hence his name. We will see him again, fighting the Persian king Darius here. And initially, it looks like the Persian king is winning, because he's higher and reaches out toward Alexander. But in fact, you see his charioteer here whipping the horses who are retreating as Alexander advances, and these spears that surround the Persian king are in fact the spears of the Macedonian army. In fact, there's a very interesting formal evocation here between the dead tree and the arm of Darius. You notice the arm of Darius in his hands sort of duplicates what you see here in the branch of the dead tree. So making an analogy between the death that awaits Darius in the near future as a consequence of his engagements with Alexander. You'll find the same sort of interaction of figures and landscapes used by Michelangelo in the ceiling of the Sistine Chapel, but this is one of the earliest instances of it. Alexander, you notice, wore no helmet. You find the same sort of thing with the Romans. They were never shown with the Roman emperors, never shown with a helmet. They didn't need a helmet. They were so brave, they could do it without one. And again, Alexander is one of the first examples of that sort of technique. He will be victorious over the Persians in each of the areas in which he engages them, as all of the oracles of Apollo, these special priests who could commune with Apollo and see the future, all of the priests at these special sites of Apollo in Siwa, Didyma in Xanthos, all told Alexander that he would be successful over the Persians, as indeed he was. After the Battle of Gaugamela in northern Iraq, he marches south toward Babylon and formally enters the city through the Ishtar Gate, which you're seeing on the right, currently in Berlin, which is the major entrance to the site built by King Nebuchadnezzar in the early 6th century BC, and luxuriates in the palace that Nebuchadnezzar had once had and which the Persians had controlled for so long since the conquest of Nebuchadnezzar in the 6th century BC. And these images that you're seeing here, some of these dragons are the sacred animal of Marduk, who is the one of the chief gods of the Babylonian religion. Alexander will go all the way to Persepolis and will sack the city, going into the palace of the Persian emperors and deciding to burn it to get revenge on the Persians for their destruction of the Athenian Acropolis 150 years earlier. So you're seeing the ruins of the palace at Persepolis on the left, again burned by Alexander and his troops, and they also seem to have defaced some of the reliefs in Persepolis. So additional iconoclasm here, just the head that's been chiseled away. You can see some of the marks of the hammer or the chisel, just to obliterate the features of the head. So again, this sort of iconoclasm that we're seeing so much of in the Middle East these days is something that has a very great antiquity. He would continue on beyond the Persian borders. Darius III ultimately would be killed in northern Iran, modern-day northern Iran, but his crown would be taken by one of the satraps, a man named Bessus, B-E-S-S-U-S, who was a satrap in Bactria, ancient Afghanistan. Ancient Afghanistan is generally referred to by the title of Bactria, B-A-C-T-R-I-A. And Alexander would chase Bessus through Afghanistan and Uzbekistan for nearly a year before he caught him and killed him. This involved going over the Hindu Kush Mountains that separate northern from southern Afghanistan. And you're seeing them on the screen on the left. Going through those mountains was no easy feat, then or now. And there was no firewood that they had, that Alexander and the Greek army had, as they were going over the mountains. So we hear stories of them being forced to eat the meat from their mules raw in order to keep going over the mountains and again into modern-day Uzbekistan in their search for Bessus. And when they finally caught him, they did exactly the sort of thing that Darius had done in the inscription from Behistun. They gouge out his eyes and they cut off his ears. And I'm just showing you as an illustration of that, something that has a much more remote antiquity, the bronze statue reportedly or allegedly of Sargon of Akkad, so late 3rd millennium BC from Baghdad. This was one of the objects looted from the Baghdad Museum during the recent war and recently, fortunately, returned. But you can see that it too suffered iconoclasm. The ears have been cut off and the eyes have been gouged out. This is not the sort of thing that happens to a bronze statue when it falls down. This is deliberate iconoclasm, and Bessus experienced the same sort of thing, again, along the lines of what Darius had discussed on the Behistun inscription. Alexander kept on going, even after having put Bessus to death, because he was interested in moving as far east as he could get away with moving and not have the army revolt. The army went quite a ways, all the way to northwestern India by the time it was all over. But when Alexander was in northern Afghanistan, he actually married a woman named Roxanne, and you're seeing a replica of a painting from Pompeii on the right, as you can see in very fragmentary state, that probably shows Alexander on the left and Roxanne on the right, this daughter of a northern Bactrian noble, so someone from the region of modern-day Mazar-i Sharif. And she would be the only woman who would bear a child to Alexander. When Alexander got to a region of northeastern Iran, southeastern Uzbekistan, so in the region up here, he found a very unusual settlement that was occupied by Greek speakers. These were descendants of a group of priests from the sanctuary of Apollo at Didyma, a sanctuary in south, in a sense, western Turkey, a little toward the south, right on the coast. Didyma, which you see on the right as one of the most majestic Greek temples in western Turkey, originally built in, or the construction starts in the 6th century BC. It never is finished. Goes on for about 1,000 years. But still, it's one of the most majestic temples that we have, and certainly one of the most important Apollo sanctuaries of all of those in the eastern Mediterranean. During the Persian Wars, the priests of this sanctuary had betrayed their sanctuary to the Persians. So they had allied themselves with the Persians and thus committed an unforgivable offense. And the Persians resettled them on the eastern side of their empire, which was here, modern-day Afghanistan and Uzbekistan. And Alexander came across them, Greek speakers who worshipped Greek gods and who identified themselves as descendants of these Greek priests who had betrayed their city to the Persians. Now, this is 150 years later. The people who lived here had nothing to do with any betrayal to the Persians. But Alexander sacked the entire area and put them all to death, again, because their ancestors had betrayed a Greek sanctuary to their Persian overlords rather than be attacked. The last major foe that Alexander would have to wrestle with would be a man named Poros, P-O-R-O-S. And his fight with Poros would take him into Pakistan, into central northern Pakistan. Poros was a regional king, a kind of Raja, who attacked Alexander's army with as many as 300 elephants, which had not commonly been done before. And you're seeing this commemorated on a coin from Bactria that shows Poros here with a spear over his head aimed at Alexander, who, like the Alexander mosaic, looks like he's losing. He's smaller, he's lower, but nevertheless, of course, it's a foregone conclusion that he's going to win. And as Alexander went through this region, he named quite a number of cities after him. So there were ultimately about 30 cities named after Alexander the Great. He even named one after Bucephalus, his horse, Bucephala, which is up here in northern Pakistan in the general region of Rawalpindi. And there are a number of sites that you know are named after Alexander, but you've forgotten that they are. Alexander in Persian and in Turkish is called Iskender. And Iskender gradually morphed into Kandah, and Kandahar is just another name for Alexander. So all of these bombings that have occurred at Kandahar in the last 2 years are occurring in a city that was founded, in fact, by Alexander the Great. Alexander would ultimately, in 324, be forced by his army to go back west, as far as Babylon before he died. Whether it was typhus or alcoholism, which is one of the things being cited now, or poison or pleurisy, it's hard to say. But he died in 323. And, of course, his memory was perpetuated by his successors. This was a larger-than-life figure, more prominent than many gods who were worshipped in the area. And not surprisingly, you see him featured prominently on the coins of his successor. Here's one by Ptolemy, king of Egypt, that shows the deified Alexander wearing an elephant scalp on his head. You can see the trunk here. So he simply had taken the elephants of Poros and had it put on his head as an indication of his victory over this elephant-led army of Poros. And ultimately, you see him actually wearing the lionskin cap of Heracles, his divine ancestor, as on the Alexander sarcophagus in Istanbul, where you clearly see the lionskin adorning the features of Alexander. Now, in spite of this effort to set up elaborate kingdoms throughout the Near East in the region that was formerly governed by the Persians, everything would fall apart about 18 months after Alexander died, certainly in Afghanistan and in many of the other areas. There would be a number of kings who would come out of this tradition, though, who would, in a sense, could be called Greco-Persian. Alexander himself could be called Greco-Persian in that toward the end of his life, he had adopted Persian garb. Persian ceremonial, even Persian proskynesis, the prostrating yourself before the king. All of these were ultimately absorbed by Alexander. He married his members of his army, the elite in his army, to members of the Persian royal family. So there was a very clear intermixture of Greek and Persian already in the 4th century BC. And you see it in later kings as well, two of whom I wanted to single out. One is Mithridates of Pontus, whom you see on the left, who would claim descent from Cyrus the Great, the founder of the Persian Empire, on his father's side, and from Alexander on his mother's side. So he had the best of both. And you see him wearing the lion skin on his head, just as Alexander had done, to accentuate his connection to the royal Macedonian family. He sacked much of the Black Sea area in the course of the late 2nd, early 1st centuries BC. And during the so-called Mithridatic Wars, a part of Troy, which you're seeing again in aerial view here, was destroyed. So this entire sanctuary was burned in the early 1st century BC. And one of the buildings in the sanctuary, which was very heavily damaged, the Trojans decided to leave as a ruin to the to commemorate the extent of the battle that had nearly extinguished, the extent of the savagery of the battle that had nearly extinguished life in the town. So essentially following the same sort of model that had been used by Athens on the Acropolis. It was never built over, but always left as a ruin. And the second king that I wanted to mention was a man named Antiochus of Commagene, living in southeastern Turkey during the 1st century BC. And one of the areas under his control was Zeugma, here in southeastern Turkey, which has been very much in the news these days. You see it in plan on the left, and aerial view, not an aerial view, I took this a couple summers ago, after a dam had been built that flooded much of the area. So you're seeing, of course, the Euphrates River here, which has dramatically changed appearance. In the course of the recent emergency excavations, sponsored in large part by the Packard Humanities Institute, some reliefs of Antiochus of Commagene were found, still unpublished, and some inscriptions that relate to these reliefs. You see the relief being found on the left, and the relief here that shows Antiochus of Commagene in good Persian garb, shaking hands with Helios, the sun, the Greek sun god. Antiochus of Commagene was another one, another king, who claimed descent from Alexander the Great on his mother's side and descent from Cyrus the Great on his father's side. It worked well. Why not keep doing it? And the inscription, which is still unpublished, I'll read to you. I came to believe piety to be of all good things, not only the securest possession, but also the sweetest enjoyment for men. And after succeeding to my ancestral kingdom, I immediately established this new sanctuary of the ancient power of Zeus or Ormazdes and of Apollo, Mithras, Helios, Hermes. I made the honor of the great gods grow in step with my own fortune. So you see the extent to which we've got this syncretism, this blend of Greek and Persian gods. Some Persian gods, some Greek gods, the cults have become essentially one by the time we get to the end of the Hellenistic period, this period of the 3rd, 2nd, and 1st centuries BC. Meanwhile, what was happening in Afghanistan? We don't have the same sort of emphasis on Greco-Persian kings in this area as we do further to the west. We're again looking at a map of Afghanistan here and the surrounding countries. In much of the Hellenistic period, parts of Afghanistan were ruled by Greek kings who were descendants of the veterans who had been left there by Alexander the Great. So many of the inscriptions that we get from Afghanistan are in Greek because there were any number of Greek cities that had been built in both the southern and northern parts of the country. The most prominent of them is probably Ayin Khanum in the northeast. Again, not so far from Mazar-i Sharif. And you're seeing a view of the excavations of Ayin Khanum on the right. This is very much a Greek city. So you have a gymnasium with inscriptions to Heracles and Hermes. You have an inscription that records the wisest sayings from Delphi in central Greece. And so in the excavations at Ayin Khanum, at one point they found this inscription. As children, this is in Greek, as children learn good manners, as young men learn to control passion, in middle age be just, in old age give good advice, and die without regret, which of course we all do. But more to the point, this was written down in the sanctuary of Apollo at Delphi, and it had been copied at Delphi and brought all the way to northeastern Afghanistan. And there was an inscription with this inscription saying, I went to Delphi and copied this down and came all the way to northeastern Afghanistan, and here it is. So it shows you the extent to which, even by this period, even in the Hellenistic period, you've got this tight bond between mainland Greece and even regions as far east as northeastern Afghanistan. There were quite a number of small finds, even large finds, from Ayi Kanum and from these other Greek cities in Afghanistan. You see one of the reliefs on the left, the Trojan horse, which is being led into the city by Trojans, and Cassandra waving her arms saying, this will spell destruction for your city. So there was no problem with representing illustrations of the great Greek epics in these big Greek cities of Afghanistan. They were just like any other Greek city, even as far west as southern Italy and Sicily. And from Begram, the site of the American Air Force base now, there was a palace, a large mansion from the first, second centuries AD, where these two beautiful glass goblets were found, probably imports from Alexandria and probably dating to the first century AD. They too show scenes from Greek myths, Ganymede being carried off into the heavens by Zeus in the form of an eagle, and Europa, so a reference to Europe, even though we're in central Afghanistan, being carried from Phoenicia, modern-day Lebanon, to Crete on the back of a bull, which of course was Zeus in disguise. In the same area, we have Chinese lacquered objects, ivories from India, and other objects imported from Alexandria. So a kind of treasure house, which shows the extent to which Afghanistan, ancient Bactria, had become a kind of clearinghouse for trade in the late Hellenistic period. The coinage from this area, from the Greek kings of Afghanistan, were also singled out as some of the principal achievements of this time and place. I'm just showing you two examples from the early 2nd century BC, one of Demetrius on the left, still wearing the perpetually appropriate elephant scalp, and one of Antimachus on the right, wearing the Macedonian hat, even though, again, we're in eastern Afghanistan, still showing the link between the two areas, Greece and Afghanistan. Now, also, we get influence from Indian kings, especially in the 3rd century BC, the so-called Mauryan dynasty. And the man who we most remember from this dynasty, a man named Ashoka, who's come from northwestern India to rule the area in the 3rd century BC, was originally quite a warlord along the lines of Alexander the Great, and then he converted to Buddhism. So that means being a vegetarian, that means a policy of nonviolence. And after he converted to Buddhism, he ordered that inscriptions in Greek and Aramaic be set up throughout the empire that he controlled, and I'll read that to you. These have been found all over Afghanistan and fairly recently in Kandahar. In the 8th year of his reign, Ashoka conquered Kalinga. 150,000 persons were captured and deported, and 100,000 others were killed, and almost as many died otherwise. Thereafter, pity and compassion seized the king, and he suffered grievously. And now the king abstains from killing human beings, and other men who are huntsmen and fishermen of the king have stopped hunting. And the king made men more pious and issued the edicts of piety, one of which you see on the right. Again, this one from Kandahar. Some men were intemperate in the past, but they have now ceased their intemperance, and they are obedient to their fathers, their mothers, and their elders. In opposition to the past, so also in the future, men will live better and more happily here, and everything will thrive throughout our world forever. This is central Afghanistan, 3rd century BC. This, of course, wouldn't last, nor would the reign of Ashoka and his successors last, but Buddhism would catch on and would get a special shot in the arm in the period between the 1st and the 5th century AD, where we move into the so-called Gandharan School of Sculpture, a group of settlers from Western China, the Yuchi, come into Afghanistan and bring with them a passion for Buddhism. It's this period from the 1st to the 5th century AD that we get so many wonderful statues of Buddha carved in Afghanistan and in many cases still surviving. You see a small one on the left and a very large one on the right, this one from Bamiyan. And you can gauge the size by this person here. This is over 50 meters high, so over 150 feet high. You can see that what these are really are orientalized versions of Apollo. What they've done is to take standard Apollo iconography, both in terms of dress and in terms of the solar disk behind the head, add Buddhist elements to it, and you get a new kind of art, Greco-Buddhist, that we call Gandharan, and which is a sort of complement to the Greco-Persian monuments with which I started this talk. This period of Buddhism and of nonviolence would, of course, not last either. In the 3rd century AD, we get the Sasanians from Iran coming into the area and conquering it. So the area once again comes under the jurisdiction of Iran under Shapur I, the king of the mid-3rd century AD. And I'm showing you one of his victory reliefs set up very near those triumphal reliefs of Darius in Behistun that I showed you at the beginning of the talk. In this particular case, you can see Shapur celebrating his victory over the Roman emperors. Normally, you're used to seeing the triumphal monuments in Rome that show the Romans sacking the Persians or the Sasanians. Now, in Persia, we get the Sasanians sacking the Romans. So the Roman emperor Valerian, Gordian III, he's dead down here, and Philip the Arab begging for mercy from the Sasanian king. The Sasanians, just successors of the Parthians, who in turn were successors of the Persians. Warfare will continue to haunt Afghanistan in the 5th century AD as the Huns come through the area. The Sasanians will grab it again in the 6th century, and then it will ultimately be taken over by the Arabs toward the end of the 7th century. As we go through subsequent centuries in this area, the stories of the past continue to be celebrated, and I just brought two slides in to emphasize that. So stories of the Trojan War, stories of the Persian Wars, you can still find presented in elaborate form. The slide on the left shows the Judgment of Paris contest on the slopes of Mount Ida down the road from Troy. You remember the original contest where Paris chose which of three goddesses was the most beautiful and gave a golden apple to Aphrodite. That started the whole Trojan War. You can still see that reenacted every August at Troy where the original Judgment of Paris contest took place. So you see three latter-day Helens here on the left. And episodes of the Persian Wars don't still take place, but as recently as 1971, on the anniversary of the Shah's celebration of the 2,500th year anniversary of the foundation of the Persian Empire, he took all of the members, not all, but the elite members of the Iranian army, dressed them in ancient Persian garb, and staged an elaborate festival, again to highlight the link between the ancient kings of Persia and his current regime. In effect, Shapur had done the same thing by putting his rock-cut reliefs next to those of the early Persians. Even Alexander the Great can still be found in many areas in Central Asia and the Near East. If you were to go to parts of Iran at various points in the Middle Ages and also now, you find poets, storytellers, who circulate through the area, one of whom you see here, telling the story of Alexander. And you're seeing a canvas here that shows Alexander with Darius III celebrating a story, which is, of course, apocryphal, that as Darius III died in Alexander's arms, he bequeathed his kingdom to Alexander. Now, of course, this never happened, but it makes a great story, and it certainly makes Alexander look a lot better than he might otherwise have looked. So Alexander cradling Darius in his arms as the story continues to be told. And if you go to northeastern Afghanistan, you can still find the Kalash, whom you see on the right and whom all of you know from the movie The Man Who Would Be King with Sean Connery and Michael Caine from 1975. allegedly descendants of the descendants of Alexander the Great, who still speak some Greek and still worship some Greek gods. And this takes us then to the modern period, where you still find, as I started off the lecture, two powerful themes that continue to be highlighted, continue to be felt in the everyday life of the people who lived here. That's to say, iconoclasm attempts to erase history, a search for the most appropriate form that would commemorate the battles that have ravaged the region. You see on the left, of course, an American soldier in the process of destroying an image of Saddam Hussein. And on the right, you see that Buddha that I just showed you a few minutes ago in Bamiyan, now simply a cavity because the entire image of the Buddha was blown up by the Taliban about 3 years ago. It's these two things that I want you to keep in mind, this attempt to erase history and the fear of the erasure of history, which, as you see, going all the way back to that inscription of Darius, was one of the primary concerns of the people who have lived here. And I want to end with a quote from Hammurabi, the king of Babylon, who lived 3,800 years ago, about 1800 BC, and whose portrait is now very timely because it adorns the new Iraqi currency, Saddam Hussein having been removed. So this is what Hammurabi wrote 3,800 years ago, which highlights the same themes that I've been stressing throughout the talk. In future time, through all coming generations, let those who control this land observe the words of righteousness which I have written on my monument. Let them not alter the law of the land that I have given, the edicts that I have enacted, and let them not deface my monuments. If future rulers who occupy this land do not esteem my words, which I have written in this inscription, then may the years of their rule be marked by groaning, by years of scarcity, years of famine, darkness without light, death with seeing eyes, and the removal of their name and memory from our land. Thanks very much for coming out tonight and for listening to me. Thank you.
As usual, our speaker will answer questions for 10 or 15 minutes before we have the reception outside. And I'll just turn the mic over to him again.
Yes.
Was the
The stirrup used for a horse.
Made possible to fight on horseback because without stirrups you are unstable. Now, as far as you see on those pictures, Alexander and all the other people fought on horseback without stirrups. Is that correct?
The question was on the origin of stirrups for riding on horseback. Now, you're going to ask a lot of questions with which I'm not as familiar as I would be if we were discussing the archaeology of Troy, but I will say the earliest stirrups I know of are early medieval. You certainly can fight on horseback without stirrups. As you yourself have said, in these images that I've shown you, nobody has stirrups, and they're doing perfectly fine. It must have been very easy to fall off of your horse in the course of such a battle, and that man from Chan wearing the awkward armor certainly did fall off of his horse. So I suspect that happened quite a bit of the time. But yes, you're certainly right from what I can see in the archaeological evidence. Yes? Balkh was the question was about Balkh, B-A-L-K-H, in northern Afghanistan, which this gentleman had visited, I suspect, prior to 1979. Yeah, because since 79, it's not been an easy region to get to. Balkh was the capital of Bactria, so it was a major city. That's where Roxanne came from. And of course, you still find women in Afghanistan named Roxanne. And if you remember in The Man Who Would Be King, the woman whom he tries to marry is named Roxanne. So it was a major area. I'm sure there's a great deal to find there. I'm sure there's a great deal that's being looted there. It was also in or around Balkh that Zarathustra, Zoroaster, died, the man who founded Zoroastrianism. So it's got many claims to fame and quite a history that spanned easily 1,000 years. Again, I'm sure there's a great deal to find there. And I just want to emphasize one of our biggest dangers in this area, we as archaeologists, as students of history, is that history is systematically being murdered in this area, and that so much plundering is occurring because the areas are just too difficult to guard since warfare ravages the area. So tell your friends, if your teachers tell your students, make them aware of the looting that's going on and how we have to combat this looting any way we can. We're certainly, in the Archaeological Institute of America, we're trying to do it as extensively as we can, but we need everyone to go out and spread the word and tell your friends not to buy cylinder seals on eBay, which is now possible to do for very little, because this flood of cylinder seals on eBay, many of which are from Iraq, some of which are from Afghanistan, have come onto the market because of this warfare that's been that's so marked the region. Yes. Yes. Did they have drawers in the army? Both in the Hellenistic period and in the Roman period, they took artists with them on campaign to represent the major battles. And so this was originally a triumphal painting that was done probably in the late 4th century B.C. and then copied in Pompeii in 100 B.C., probably for one of the Romans who had fought a Macedonian campaign, a Macedonian war, since there were Macedonian wars throughout the 2nd century B.C. These paintings would then be carried in triumphal processions. So since you couldn't bring back videos for the people of what you had done, you would paint the major episodes of your battles on these canvases, and then you would carry them in the course of your triumphal procession. So it would be like old-fashioned film strips, episode 1, episode 2, episode 3, on these big banners that were being carried through the streets. You can see the you can see these big paintings carried by the soldiers in the reliefs on the Arch of Titus in Rome. Some of them had paintings, some of them had slogans, like Wainy Weedy Weeky, that was on one of them, from Caesar's campaigns. But yes, they brought artists with them. Yes? How would Alexander be viewed in this area today, as a foreign invader or as one of them? You know, it depends on whom you ask. And it depends on what's just happened. I mean, this is, of course, a very large area. If we're dealing with Turkey, Alexander still has a very positive reputation. There are pockets of Iran where he has still a kind of heroic reputation. There are far more pockets in Iran where he has a negative reputation as a conqueror who sacked the Persian Empire. There are parts of Afghanistan where he would have a positive reputation, especially in the Kalash area, Kafiristan, and probably around Balkh, he would have a positive reputation, although I can't vouch for that. As things change in Afghanistan, as the foreign occupation grows longer, I don't know, maybe Alexander's reputation would change as a consequence of that. I mean, it's a good question, but for the reputation of these figures from antiquity, it was never static. It was always fluid based upon what's happening now politically in those regions. So my answer is yes and no. In some areas positive, in some areas negative, and that will change as the military and political events of those regions change. Yes? Yes. Well, we've never found the body of Alexander. He dies, of course, in Babylon. He's on his way back to Macedonia and then is hijacked by Ptolemy and is buried in Alexandria in a large circular mound, possibly, yes, with amber. But we've never found the tomb. We have descriptions of the tomb. Of course, you know, we've had trouble finding anything in Alexandria. That's been a very elusive city for us. But Alexandria was his last resting place. Well, I'm sure that, you know, everyone would like to find the tomb of Alexander. You know, I'd love to find it. But I'm sure there will be renewed interest, but it remains to be seen what will happen. There was a question in the back. Yes. Oh, that's a good question. Rather than just destroying the image, you commemorate the act of destroying it. They did that also in antiquity. When you destroy an image, when you batter it, you can either finish it off smoothly, you can make it look as if the person who was there was never there. They do that in the later Roman period. And the person is completely removed. There's no indication that he was ever there, he or she was ever there. Then you get a specialized version of iconoclasm, which is very old, goes all the way back to at least Hatshepsut in ancient Egypt, where they will batter the image, but they will leave the marks of the battering there as a warning to what could happen to you if you got out of line or engaged in treason against the ruling power. This is really not so far removed from it. Yes.
Maybe I'm missing something, but I thought earlier you showed a picture of a telegraph having its photograph taken after it was supposed to be detached.
You must contact the Taliban about that. I would say it is ironic. And I would say that image was completely destroyed in the next moment after the shutter clicked. What's being highlighted is his role as an iconoclast and thus as a hero. But you're right, that's iconic in its own right. Yes. The child, Alexander's child, by Roxanne, was killed in 310 by Cassander, one of his Macedonian associates. Everybody was hungry for the legacy of Alexander, and that child's life was, the days of the child's life were numbered once Alexander died. Yes. There were various questions that you asked. Alexander had a lot of people with him. I mean, we can't judge all the numbers in every case, but he left behind him about 13,000 people when he left Afghanistan. 13,000 in that general area of Iraq and Afghanistan. Iran and Afghanistan. Was there a major impact? Yes. I mean, if you look at the settlements in the areas that had been conquered by Alexander, you see a blend of Hellenic culture and the local culture. Now, in some cases, that was short-lived. You know, it went on for only a few years, and then there was a rebellion against it. In other areas, obviously, it took root. I mean, in Afghanistan, which is the area that I've highlighted here, even the form of the Buddha that develops in the first century AD is based on a version of Apollo as it would have been presented by the Greeks. I mean, those images, even though the subjects are Buddhist, the style and many of the aspects of the costume and attributes are the product of Greek sculptors. I mean, clearly sculptors from the eastern part of the Roman Empire were brought into Afghanistan to do these enormous images for the Kushan rulers who wanted the Buddhists presented. So, you know, this is a situation where 400 years after the death of Alexander, you still have Hellenic culture playing a fairly prominent role, even in terms of the icons of a religion that's coming from the East. So the impact was tremendous. And of course, it can still be felt in various capacities throughout this area. So in some areas, the impact was enormous. In some cases, it was short-lived. And then you find places where it worked for 100 or 200 years and then gradually ebbed away. Okay, one more question.
The battle marathon, if the Persians had defeated the Greeks, what kind of Persian society would we see today?
If the Persians had won at Marathon instead of the Greeks, what would the world be like today? I can't even imagine what would have been what it would have been like. I imagine that, let's say they won at Marathon, and let's say there was no Salamis or Plataea, and that they simply subjugated the Greeks and installed satraps in mainland Greece, as they had done in western Turkey and in Afghanistan and in all of the regions in between. Would there have been an Acropolis? Would there have been a Parthenon? No, because there would have been no Delian League, which gathered the money that enabled the Parthenon to be built. The world would be a very different place if the Persians had won at Marathon. I can't even imagine how different. That was a critical moment in history. I see that Hector's standing, so I gather that...
One more question.
Okay. If there's one more question, I'll be happy to take it. Yes. Yes. You studied it, yes. Yeah, the question was about Xenophon, who was a famous writer and soldier about 400 BC. There was a kind of civil war in Persepolis. Two men, Artaxerxes II and Cyrus the Younger, who claimed title to the Persian throne. And Cyrus the Younger brought a whole group, 10,000 Greek mercenaries to help him seize the throne, and it didn't work. But all of these Greek mercenaries went deep into the Persian Empire before the situation changed and Artaxerxes emerged supreme and Cyrus was killed. And then they had to march all the way back again. And Xenophon described the march back toward the west, and it's one of our best indications of the geography of that region circa 400 BC. And if I have to link Xenophon's march with anything that I showed today, it's about the same time as you get the Spartans fighting the Anatolians in the early 4th century BC, as indicated on that painted sarcophagus from the region of Chan in the Granicus River Valley.
Before I ask our thanker to address the speaker, I'd just like to remind you, any of you who are interested in archaeology, Brian is first vice president of the Archaeological Institute, and I'm past president of the Canadian branch of the Archaeological Institute of America, that we do have meetings every month in the winter, and we do welcome new members. There are forms, if you're interested, out on the table and some down here. Our next meeting is on February 10th, Tuesday at 7:30 at the Museum of Anthropology, when we'll hear about new light on the city of Midas, ancient Gordian. Now it gives me great pleasure to ask a general trustee of the Archaeological Institute of America, a past president of the Underwater Archaeological Society of BC, and the present chair of the Board of Governors of the Vancouver Maritime Museum, Robin Woodward, to thank Professor Rose.
It's my very great pleasure to thank Brian Rose this evening because I think he has so eloquently linked the events of the past to the events of the present by reminding us that conquering armies and the government-sanctioned destruction of cultural heritage, which is going on today, that these conflicts actually and the types of systematic destruction of history has gone on really since the 6th century B.C., the defacing of the Persian royal reliefs by Alexander the Great, I don't think are any more or less criminal in our minds today as what is going on right now by the Taliban. Or the looting and destruction of some of the sites then may seem less more remote to us, actually, and because they happened so long ago, than those that are being beamed into our living rooms today by satellite televisions. And the destruction of the Buddhas that have gone on, it just seems that it's happened. It's been so distasteful to us now, but it really has gone on for a very long time. And I think this linking of the past to the present has been wonderful this evening. I've also been very fortunate to visit many of the sites in northern Pakistan, or what used to be the northwest frontier of India, and actually gone to the Valley of the Kalesh, where Alexander the Great was, and visited with those people for several days. I was at that time retracing the footsteps of my great-grandfather, who had entered that area at the head of another conquering army, the British Army, 100 years ago, by leading a regiment of Gurkhas. And I grew up with Kalesh grave figures adorning our family dining room, because those were souvenirs that he brought back from that point. But the rapid advances in 20th century weaponry and somehow make our weapons today seem more destructive. Governments seem less respectful of people's cultural past, and we, as the general public, seem less respecting. Whereas the collection of ancient artifacts used to be the purview of just a very few museums and very wealthy individuals, the rapid expansion of the global antiquities market and internet shopping opportunities that we all avail ourselves of are really making it something that the general public is contributing to. So I would encourage everybody to be more temperate, be more respectful of people's cultural past and history, and like the people, and learn, I think, to celebrate our collective histories and respect them, and don't purchase them in the future, because they will then stop destroying these sites. I'd like to thank Brian Rose. I had the opportunity of listening to him speak in San Francisco earlier this year on this subject, and I think we all have much to learn from the people of the Gandhar civilization that looked at stopping the destruction and celebrating our past. Thank you very much.
And there is coffee, and shortly there'll be biscuits upstairs. Next week's lecture is Mr. Jim Fulton, Executive Director of the David Suzuki Foundation on Climate Chaos.